This is day six of this March 2016 7-day session. We'll take one more day on the teachings of 20th century Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim, and we're reading from a book called The Way of Korean Zen. We're picking up now from a section called Discourses from a Winter Retreat. Being bound by circumstances originates from the mind's own bondage. Likewise, liberation from the suffering of birth and death ensues from the mind's being liberated from them. This is the Dharma of one mind. Everything there is proceeds from this one mind. Access to the doors of both liberation and bondage lies in your own hands. It is not dependent upon anyone else. It is not dependent upon the Buddhas, nor the patriarchs, nor the teachers. It is solely in your own hands. Since the subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment has been present even before the creation of the earth, it has never been lost. Why do you say that you are looking for it again? From long ago until now, it has been unimpeded and has been shining brightly and tranquilly. Some words of the Buddha. This mind is bright and self-luminous, but it is stained by adventitious defilements. So its nature is bright and luminous. And it's only because of adventitious defilements, in more contemporary terms, you could say, only because of our conditioning, that we're not aware and we can't use that bright awareness until awakening. Assembly gathered here today, have you completely awakened to it or not? If there is a monk endowed with the Dharma eye, let him say something. In reality, what is this subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment? Huck! Let me introduce you to a few words from the lecture of Master Zhongjing. He once said, all sentient beings are covered by the six dusts. And then Kusan comments, this means that they are covered by the six kinds of thieves that come from the outside. It's later in this book, there is more of an explanation about these six kinds of thieves. So I'm going to read that. If you feel that you are not yet a Buddha, this means that the downfall of the six thieves is still to take place. All things in the external world that pass through the six sense doors are like thieves who are intent on cheating you. They continuously deceive you and drag you here and there. So our minds grab at sounds and sights and smells and tastes and odors and thoughts. That's the sixth in Buddhist psychology. The sixth sense is thinking. They continuously deceive you and drag you here and there. And as soon as you are deceived in even the slightest way by one of these thieves, it is equivalent to being killed by them. For at that moment, they take control of your mind. Because of them, intrinsic Buddhas are made to act like ordinary sentient beings. So there's the immediate experience of the sound, say. That's the prominent one when we're sitting in the Zendo, anyway. There's the immediate hearing, and that is fine. We have these senses. We don't want to disable them. So we hear a sound, but then all too often, that starts us off on a train of thought. And it's even the same with the sixth sense, thoughts. We have a thought going through the mind, and that's fine. That's what the brain does. It generates thoughts, thought activity. So there's the thought, and if we just left it alone, it wouldn't be a problem. But then we build on it. We take off on a train of thoughts, and that's where we lose our way and have this bright, luminous mind obscured by these clouds of thought. In the face of these six thieves, as soon as the slightest thought appears in the doorway of one of the six senses, you should be as alarmed as though a thief were trying to break into your house. The moment one of the six thieves shows itself in the doorway of the senses, the koan investigation of the essential will have deserted you. As long as the koan is held firmly in the mind, the six sense doors will be kept tightly closed, and there will be no gap through which a thief could enter. Therefore, while the koan remains vivid, you remain alive. But as soon as one of the six thieves manages to enter the door of the senses, you are already dead. In order to cause the downfall of the six thieves, you must cast aside all concern for the body. You should discard it as you would a useless stone that serves no purpose. Habitually, you blindly follow your uncontrolled attachment to the body and thus spend your entire lives trying to feed it and clothe it well, thereby making sure that it is comfortable. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been the servant of the body and have thus played the role of an ordinary sentient being. But from now on, you should learn to make it serve you. Likewise, instead of being captivated by the six senses, you should also make them obey you. Henceforth, it is you who must have the final word. In this way, your practice will be able to progress well. So again, I love the word captivated, taken captive by sounds and sights and thoughts and so forth. That's what we can avoid by being completely concentrated, if not on a koan, then a breath practice. He continues, "It is a great mistake to think that after having practiced hard for a few days, you are then entitled to lie back and enjoy yourself for a while. It is easy to find any number of pretexts for behaving in this manner. But to do so will cause you to be killed by the six thieves. Thus you will be reduced to playing the role of a corpse." And then he continues, "In addition, he's finishing the quote of this master Zong Jing, "they are enmeshed in the five aggregates, Thus they are coming and going along the path of birth and death. Well, the five aggregates or the five skandhas that we chant at the beginning of the Prajnaparamita, these are the constituents of sentient existence. The translation we use, the chanting translation of our Prajnaparamita is form, feeling, thought, and choice, and consciousness. However, he says, their original nature is never obscured. Therefore, and again he's quoting this previous master, if a poor woman were in possession of a treasure, she would bury it so deeply that no one would be able to dig it up and take it away. But even if someone were to take it away, it would still remain the same. And if the poor woman kept it in her possession, it would also remain the same. This treasure will always stay just as it is. This mind, this essential nature of ours, cannot be diminished. No matter what we do, no matter what we think, no matter what we say, there's a koan in the Blue Cliff record where Zen Master Yunmen says, there is one treasure hidden in the mountain of form. So it's not visible to most human beings because of their attachment to appearances. Seeing things as separate. But nonetheless, it is the essence of everyone, everything, this one treasure. He continues, moreover, even though a diamond is extracted from very deep within the earth, it cannot be destroyed. You should bear this in mind. The wisdom of your original nature is always clear and bright. It never changes. Everything else changes, but not this original nature, this original face of ours, our original aspect. This year, a good assembly of monks has gathered here in the monastery and is indeed making sincere efforts to practice meditation. Assembly, within this year, you must really break through the skin of ignorance. But this is not done easily and quickly. You must first give rise to the greatest possible faith and determination. You must be prepared to die. Often you practice just because others are doing so with no urgency at all. You think that it is as easy as cooling hot porridge by simply pouring a little cold water over it. Your meditation will never progress if you practice in such a way. Well, the wonderful thing about a non-monastic sangha is that people are not secluded and kept here and who don't want to be. There's so many stories of monasteries of old in all of the Asian countries, of how many monks clearly have no real interest in being there. Why are they there? It would probably be surprising to most of us that to have such a hard life, getting up at 3 or 4 in the morning every day for years or decades, and living with people who get under your skin and suffering in the cold, and the diet is so austere, and yet for some reason these monks would find themselves here, there, in ancient China. We know that many of the monks at the monasteries would have been dropped off there as children, or as orphans. They would be placed in the monasteries, and so you had all kinds of lackluster monks, and who, as he says here, often you practice just because others are doing so, with no urgency at all. When he says you must be prepared to die, I know this is makes some people squeamish when they hear this. I think it used to at some point early in my practice when I would hear that. I've never heard of anyone dying from meditation, literally. You must be prepared to give up everything in your mind is really what it means. It means renouncing the self. And the self is just a cluster of thoughts and memories and other things that have glommed together and created this false image of a self. So being prepared to die is to give up every attachment to every thought. And as we know now, on day 6 of Sesshin, this is exceedingly difficult. Fourth lecture. Today is the last day of the lunar month. The new moon is so bright that its light pervades the entire Dharma Dhatu. Notice that the new moon is so bright. Long ago, Master Nanxuan once took his assembly of monks to look at the moon. So is this moon I am talking of the same or different from the moon that Master Nanxuan gazed at? Those of you monks who are endowed with a Dharma eye, say something. Assembly of monks, it is true that these days you are exerting much effort in your practice of meditation. However, I would like to add a few words for your benefit. Of the 90 days of this winter retreat, already half have passed, for today we have reached the midpoint of the meditation season, and only 45 days are now left. I've said this before in reading this text, but for those who haven't heard it, these 90-day retreats, as they're called, can't be compared in their rigor to our 7-day sesshins. Still, they do sit a lot. There's talking, and I've been told by a monk who was at Kusan's monastery that there's a lot of sleeping too in the zendo. Still, 90 days. Every day, time flows on urgently like water. even though it may seem that there are certain enjoyments in daily life, actually, we are just like fish in a pool whose water is constantly being drained away. It's one of my favorite images to capture the inexorable passage of time and this march toward our eventual death. We are just like fish in a pool whose water is constantly being drained away. Likewise, not only you monks gathered here, but all sentient beings are traveling the path that only leads to death. As each day passes, your lifespan decreases by one day. And as each hour passes, it decreases by one hour. Just listen to this clock. With every tick, the second hand moves, pauses, and moves on again. This itself can immediately be taken as a Dharma lecture of the Buddha. Therefore, the Mara of transiency is propelling us toward death every moment. If you don't realize the truth of the unborn, then when the time of death suddenly arrives, you will find yourself moaning in illness. Even though nobody wants to die, every one of us will inevitably perish. Is there anyone here among you whose body is not a potential corpse? If there is, then speak out. Furthermore, should we live solely for the benefit of this potential corpse? Or would it be better to live in order to awaken to the truth of the unborn? When you are finally moaning in illness, then you may have regrets at not having diligently practiced while alive. But at that time, such regrets will be in vain. Therefore, why do you not practice now? Why do you just continue to play around? Well, this is in a long tradition of in Zen of the teacher trying desperately to wake up his students, have them face their inevitable passing, the certainty of the time of death and the uncertainty of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. I've come to see, and I think Kusan would not disagree, that most people just can't take this seriously. But still, serious practice goes on. It would just be so much more powerful, more potent, if it were fueled by this keen awareness of the passing of time. And not just now and then, having the sporadic awareness of our mortality, but to have it sustained, so it really fuels our practice on a daily basis. This would be a tremendous thing. But this awareness comes and goes for most of us. The mind is just like the moon rising behind a mass of clouds. It seems dim, but its brightness, like the brightness of the moon, is obscured and cannot shine forth. However, if the mind is purified, an enlightened one will appear. Keep your koan bright and do not let it darken. Everything else can be left aside, but the koan should be considered as your own life. You must try to investigate it like an old mouse entering a cow horn. In some countries, when people want to catch a mouse, they will put some fragrant oil in the pointed end of a horn and place it near the mouse's hole. The mouse is attracted by the smell, and once it thinks it is safe, crawls into the horn. It gets nearer and nearer the oil until finally its body gets stuck in the pointed end and it is unable to withdraw. In order to taste the oil, the foolish mouse has no fear of death and without any hesitation crawls right to the end of the horn. When even a mouse can be as brave as this, in order to get what it desires, shouldn't human beings put forth a similar determination of mind in order to resolve the great matter of birth and death and to realize the great truth of the universe? Shouldn't human beings cease to be preoccupied with this body and one time exert themselves in order to awaken? His references to being preoccupied with the body, putting a priority on the body. Of course, he's referring to our attachments to food and sleep and sex and other of our physical appetites. And putting these, he's saying, putting these as a priority over these transcendent desires to awaken is the height of foolishness. Desire, you know, this comparison of the mouse creeping into the cow's horn. That desire, in Buddhist terms, would be called craving. And these other attachments to the body would fall under the same category, craving. But then very different from that is the desire to awaken. Desire to awaken for the sake of all beings. Initially, I think for most of us who have this desire to awaken, it's more out of self-interest. We just want to get it for ourselves. That's more of the kind of craving. Roshi Kaplow said that when he first went to Japan, he just wanted to grab Kensho and run. But then, over time, if we persevere, our aspiration becomes refined into wanting not just to get something for ourselves, but wanting to do something for the sake of all beings, to see through this false self so that we can be of greatest service to others, to help others, to bring relief to all the suffering. So in the initial stages of practice, there may indeed be craving behind the desire for awakening. But then if one can persist, it morphs into something far more magnanimous, something selfless. You should practice with the same urgency as a person with a parched throat thinking of water. If you practice like this for some time, you will reach a point where the mind has nowhere left to go. At that moment, thoughts are absent and all delusive thinking comes to a complete halt. At such a time, the mass of questioning alone appears brilliantly before your eyes. That statement, at that moment, thoughts are absent and all delusive thinking comes to a complete halt. I remember hearing that and just longing for it, to have this restless, chattering mind come to a halt, to have silence come over it. Think sometimes of the analogy that Roshi Kaplan would use, where the mind of the ordinary person is like the static of a radio that's tuned between stations. It's not quite on any station, so it just has this static all the time. Relief to have that silence. Everyone here can realize that silence through absolute absorption in the practice. It's hard to believe when you practice day after day and can't seem to get beyond the thoughts. It's hard to believe until it happens. It doesn't happen, though, by trying to make it happen, by trying to do anything to the thoughts. It happens through single-minded absorption in whatever practice you're working on. This is not something we have to do. We have to engineer. That's the whole point. By devoting ourselves completely to the simple practice of the breath or the koan, just pure devoted concentration on it, and it will happen. It's not us doing it. It will happen. Our practice, the particular practice we're working on, is our agent. It will make it happen. But it takes complete faith in the practice we're working on. We can't keep flirting with thoughts and have it unsteady. We need to pour ourselves into this practice, and then it will always do the work. Then the last sentence, at such a time, the mass of questioning alone appears brilliantly before your eyes. Now your practice may actually seem easy, but you should be most careful since this is a very crucial moment. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been transmigrating through the suffering ocean of birth and death. Now, for one time, the mass of questioning is clear and awakening is very close by. It is as though it were screened off by a single sheet of white paper. Soon the moment will arrive when you can take revenge on birth and death through achieving liberation from them. You must be determined to pass over this crucial step. Otherwise, if you let it go by, The koan will gradually lose its vividness, and it will be even harder to reach such a state again. Therefore, do not waste this opportunity. Birth and death. You don't need to just think of it in terms of physical birth and death. Think of it as the world of change, the world of turbulent thoughts, world of loss, of loss. At this time, you will automatically forget to even sleep or eat. To not let this opportunity slip by requires true wisdom. So do not waste it. Be as resolute as the Buddha when he sat for 7 days uninterruptedly. I know how hard this is can be to believe that one can reach this state and find oneself with the mind empty. It's hard to believe until it happens. And so that's where faith comes in. That so many others before you have had the same doubts, the same sense of insufficiency, same self-doubt. All right. Self-doubt is also a thought. You don't have to banish self-doubt. Even self-doubt, you don't have to banish. You just have to throw yourself into this practice. When self-doubt arises, there's nothing we need to do with it. We don't need to battle it, try to expel it, try to suppress it. You can be aware, it's there, the voices, the inner voices. Come on. Don't be serious. You think you can do this? You can actually come to awakening? Come on. It's all right. You can just say, okay, knock yourself out, voices. But then just move. It will always, these voices will always be snapping at the mind, like jackals, like gnats. When deluded people look inside themselves, they will find there are things to be cultivated and to be gained. Therefore, they make a great effort to practice. But as soon as they have completed what they set out to do, they realize that there was nothing really to have been done. Thus, the true Dharma involves non-doing. This is what I meant by just turning it over to the koan or to the breath. Let it do the work. It's more becoming, in the case of Mu, becoming Mu, not doing anything, just thoroughly becoming Mu itself, becoming the breath. All things that are done will finally cease. Thus the Dharma of doing is the false Dharma. But everything that you do, which in reality is non-doing, constitutes eternal truth. Such actions will not cease even though you attempt to be finished with them. This is the truth of the unborn and undestroyed. In other words, all of our all of our activity, everything we do from the time we open our eyes in the morning until we close them at night, it's all the functioning of this essential nature. Even though we may be captivated by our thoughts for 18 out of 24 hours, it's still all the functioning of this self nature. We just don't know it. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.